This is RAGE, Radio Against Global Ecocide. Today on the show, the folks from Fertile Ground. Music from The Filthy Politicians, and some announcements and links you should go to on the website. This is RAGE, building a community of resistance, one podcast at a time. Hello and welcome to RAGE, Radio Against Global Ecocide, coming to you from occupied Amiskwatsi, Wisconsin, and I am your host, Seymour Life. Welcome to the second full week of RAGE. Okay, a couple announcements. Check out the RAGE website. Apparently there's some events going on in Vancouver that you should be attending. Also, a reminder that Deep Green Resistance is happening in Edmonton. Check out the website for more details. Oh, and go to Submedia TV. The show there is right on. Today is our great interview with Cameron Murphy and Jeanette Wickle of Fertile Ground, and music by Filthy Politicians. So let's get to that interview. Fertile Ground is an above-ground network dedicated to aiding the already existing efforts to dismantle industrial civilization. Cameron is a student of Western Washington University and a founding member of Fertile Ground. Jeanette Wickle is a graduate of Western Washington University and a coordinator of Fertile Ground. Welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
Thank you.
My first question really boils around as to what is and then when and how did Fertile Ground come into being?
Fertile Ground was created right around the 2009 New Year. So we're all pretty excited and happy right now to see the organization reach its one-year anniversary.
Great.
So here's how it started. After Derek Jensen came and spoke at Western Washington University in May of 2008, he was brought there by the Environmental Center at our college. A group of us, just by the stroke of luck, got into communication with each other about starting a group to carry his ideas further, so taking it to the next logical step. We began meeting once a week in November of 2008, and about a month or two later, we formally created Fertile Ground. And so it was this group of about six of us at the time, six dedicated individuals just getting together and weigh out our options to see what we wanted to do next.
Now, am I wrong in thinking that it was also tied to DGR? Or you guys held a DGR? Is that
true? We did, actually. That was something. That was our first large event.
Oh, okay.
In 2009.
Right.
It was 1 year after Derek had came in and said, we put it on this time, so the Environmental Center, and we had a follow-up workshop the following day, which was a shortened version of a DGR workshop.
Now, I'll come back to that question then, and just ask you the next one. So talk about when Fertile Ground was formed, what were the issues you had in the early days?
Yes. So like I said, Fertile Ground was formed by a group of six individuals after we saw Derek Jensen speak in Bellingham in May of 2008. Derek's message really struck us at the core, as it does for many people. And we really had no choice but to explore what actions we could realistically take. So the biggest issue at the start was the most important one, which, and it still is the most important one, which is, what are we doing? And in fact, that question has stayed with us today, and I believe it's one of the most important questions we could be asking ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
For us, living within the privileged sphere of civilization, it was difficult to decide what we could do as a group that was different from the mainstream environmental movement, which, of course, we were very frustrated with.
Cameron, you've been to three DGRs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Jeanette, you've been to at least one, right?
I've been to the one in Crescent City in September.
Right, right. So I was just wondering if you want to describe what, either of you want to describe what DGR is.
Well, it's a few different things. First, it's the title of a workshop, which is Deep Green Resistance, or more accurately, Deep Green Resistance Training. It's a three-day workshop led by Lear Keith, Eric McBay, and Derek Jensen, who lecture, lead discussions, and group exercises with participants to enact like a mock resistance movement and various activities with that. It
right.
gives the participants a philosophical basis and the practical knowledge to engage in activism in a meaningful way. It's also the title of a book coming out this spring by those same individuals. Additionally, Deep Green Resistance is a perspective emerging from within the environmental movement that views mainstream environmental activism as largely ineffective as it's currently practiced. And that word resistance, it's very important, as it refers to resisting the destruction inherent in and caused by civilization. Industrial civilization is particularly fundamentally unsustainable and must be actively dismantled in order to secure a livable future for all species on the planet. It's put more simply, the planet we call home is being destroyed at a very quick rate, and we're not going to sit by and watch this happen.
And that segues nicely into the next question, and that is that you have a separation in activism between what you call bright green and what you call deep green. So I'm wondering if you can describe the differences.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked this because this is crucial in understanding much of what is happening today, not only what we're doing. Mm-hmm. So in general, we see two possible approaches to the environmental crisis, bright green and deep green. Bright green is the typical approach that taken by the mainstream environmental movement. So this includes simple lifestyle choices and upgrades in technology. So for example, recycling, you know, that's something you're supposed to be doing at home by yourself, buying CFLs, compact fluorescent light bulbs. So that's an upgrade in technology. Driving a Prius, a hybrid car. Again, this is an individual choice about what kind of technologies you're using. More importantly, the bright green approach assumes that there will be a shift in consciousness or a major change in the culture. Because, of course, if it's up to individuals to make these choices, to use these so-called better technologies, we're going to need everyone to choose to do that on their own because it's, of course, left up to the individual. So for this reason, the bright green approach spends a lot of energy on educational campaigns and raising awareness. Of course, these things are important, but this is where deep green deviates. The deep green approach believes that we're wasting some of our time, some of our most precious time, by waiting for a cultural transformation. We have enough trouble getting people to recycle or even just not littering on the road, let alone sacrificing the convenience of their lifestyle for the sake of their land base. But because of this, that we don't believe a majority will ever do what it takes to not destroy the land we live on, the deep green approach advocates for radical institutional changes, whether the majority of the culture agrees with this or not. Now, we're simply saying, okay, we at this point, let's be honest, we know what we're doing is right, we know what we're asking for is right, and for that reason, since we're acting on behalf of the land and the members of our land base, we're not waiting. So most of this comes in the form of dismantling industrial infrastructure, which, of course, is the driving force of earth-destroying practices. So again, this is where the term resistance comes in.
What has worked well for you guys so far, like what and the things that you've been doing?
I think that two of the best things that we have going are, one, our sense of commitment. As the coordinating council, we're all completely gung-ho for this cause. And also, we have a really great connection with each other. We're all pretty much good friends, and we all get it. We work well together. And another thing that I like is that just because we're friendly doesn't mean we cut each other's slack. We like to get things done, basically, but we have fun while we do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's nice that we kind of click as a group in order to get things done more efficiently.
And now, then you have a bit of a community that you're growing there, then?
Yeah, I think so. Within the coordinating council, we've changed our structure in recent past from a membership-based organization to more of we're developing some projects, which you'll hear about a little later.
Okay.
So, but within our group, though, definitely we have a strong connection to each other.
When I was at the DGR in Crescent City, Cameron, you did a presentation there, and you talked about some of the things that you were kind of feeling were kind of stuck at. And, you know, that was a few months ago, so I'm just wondering, has things changed? Have you, you know, gone from there? And what were those things you were kind of stuck with?
Yeah, so things actually have changed. But, yeah, you're right. I was very confused at that time. A little, not, I wouldn't want to use the word hopeless, but a little realizing that the way we were approaching it wasn't necessarily working. So we felt stuck in regards to mobilizing individuals for the cause. Like Jeanette said, originally our structure was a membership-based. So we were trying to get, you know, volunteers trying to act as facilitators, organizing activist energy into projects that we thought were going to be effective. Unfortunately, what we learned was that takes a lot of energy. Mm-hmm. It's essentially, community planning, event organizing. And it really requires the micromanagement of people. And, of course, no one really likes that. No one likes doing that, and no one likes being micromanaged either. So we stepped back a little. We were so busy with organizing people that we couldn't focus on what we've wanted to do most of all, which is deep green education. So a lot of people know that the environmental movement is not doing too well right now, and we really want to get out there and talk with people, bring that up and say, yes, you're right, the environmental movement is failing, so what else can we do? I truly believe that a lot of people know this, but for whatever reason, they're afraid to come out and say it. And for, understandable reasons, because unfortunately, on the left of the environmental movement, we end up being shouted down for even suggesting that things aren't going very well. Yeah, and of course, we want to change that. We want to say it's okay to it's okay to step back and say what we're doing isn't working.
Right.
So we might have, I think we sort of realized we were doing things too quickly. We were trying to organize people and trying to even build community at a point when, build community with these all these big groups of people. We had even some meetings where there'd be 30 people there, 30 activists who were pretty energetic, and we just realized we might have jumped the gun and we weren't ready. And when you realize that happens, you just have to step back and say, okay, what's going on here?
And so what have you done? We use a sort of a non-membership base to a different base. Can you describe that base a little bit more, what you mean?
Yeah,
by,
definitely. I guess right now I would say we are working on personal development. So this is working on our own skills. I guess to give an example of another organization I'm thinking of, it's a feminist organization. It's called Stop Porn Culture, and the We Are Keith is actually in that as well. And instead of being a membership-based organization, meaning they rely on the energy of their members, their organization just really consists of about five key board members, and they will travel around and give presentations and essentially working on this raising awareness and education again. So this might sound like a contradiction because I was saying, Bright Green focuses on education,
mm-hmm.
and that's true, and that's what we're trying to do as well, but it's a different kind of education, and it's not simply saying, okay, people, you need to turn off the lights when you're not doing using an appliance, unplug the outlet because, phantom energy. We're saying, okay, no, we're talking about education in terms of resistance, education in terms of organizing people, saying, okay, what can we really do? What can we do that's going to bring about effective change within, the next 10 years, the next 20 years?
Right.
So it's different in that sense.
So you're talking about radicalism versus lifestyleism, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, education alone is not necessarily the most effective, but it's, of course, what you're educating people on. So that is how our base has shifted, and such that just the main core members, like Jeanette and I, we're getting together and we're working on outreach materials. We're working on presentations, developing our public speaking skills, going through mock Q&As, because, of course, there's a lot of basic questions that come up.
Right.
And just working on that self-development.
Okay, so go a little deeper then into your organization here, because I'm looking at your website, and you have a list of things that you believe in, or a statement of beliefs. And so I just want to touch on a few of them that sort of stuck out for me personally. And the first one is, industrial civilization is undermining everything, every living system on the planet. What do you mean by this?
It basically means that every biological system on Earth is in decline in terms of biodiversity, number of organisms, and for the variability for Earth to sustain life and even the climate. So, and these occurrences can be traced to any number of activities characteristic of civilization. For example, how many native prairie grasses do you see growing in strip mall parking lots? How many old-growth forests do you see amidst skyscrapers? The fact is that civilization has the power to bully life off the planet, and it is doing that.
So basically you're saying the way we're living is essentially killing the planet.
It is.
Yeah.
It's not so much how you and I individually are living, but it's the structures that have been in place that we have essentially no choice but to participate in.
Right. Okay. And then the other one you have on there is most injustices are systematic and deliberate. Can you explain that one further?
So let's talk about the loss of topsoil. So what's responsible for this? Well, for one, industrial agriculture. It's no surprise to anyone keeping up with the environmental movement that industrial petrochemical-supported monocultures, such as corn, are destroying topsoil. As a culture, as we, around the world, we continue to do this, and on a very large scale. We know it destroys topsoil, and we know it ruins carrying capacity of the planet for later generations, but we continue to do it. But we can look at human injustices as well. So the U.S. is killing large numbers of innocent civilians in at least four other countries, mm-hmm. these being Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen. Okay, and this is, it doesn't matter if it's a Democrat or Republican in office, we're bombing them still, and we're killing innocent civilians. What's my point? All of this is systematic, and it's deliberate. It doesn't matter who our president is. The U.S. is going to attack foreign countries and kill innocent civilians, unfortunately, for a number of reasons. And it doesn't matter who our CEOs are. Corporations are going to continue destroying the Earth. So the problems are deeper than the individual. They're culturally and institutionally rooted.
So as much as people don't want to pretend that the war in Iraq wasn't about oil, it's about oil.
Yeah, I believe that's one reason, definitely. Yeah.
This next one is one I found really interesting because it's a topic I hear and people saying all the time, and that is technological innovation will not prevent the systematic degradation of our planet. Why not?
The unfortunate truth is that technology, which is commonly understood as increasingly complex scientific innovation, it's absolutely not sustainable due to its inherent nature of using non-renewable, finite materials. For example, solar panels are great until you run out of silicon, or the material needed to create the machinery to process the silicon, and so on. Additionally, technology of this sort only serves the dominator mentality that humans have the intelligence and capabilities to govern and dominate over nature. And the further we go down this path, the faster we accelerate the demise of humanity and the demise of the whole planet.
That's something I hear a lot from people say, they'll come up with something, and people sort of pass it off at that. Yeah, I hear that quite a bit, especially people of my age. Next one. Our current civilization needs to be replaced by thousands of cultures that are fully integrated with their local ecosystems. How does this come into being?
Well, this is a great question, and it's honestly something that it's really difficult to answer because we don't live in that kind of culture. None of us have any personal familiarity with that. I can assume that it would take lots of time, generations, take a lot of unlearning, a lot of being open and learning the knowledge of indigenous peoples.
Yeah, it's a really complex question, obviously, because it starts tying into the indigenous peoples of each land who presumably are connected with that land base. And that gets into the issues of, are they going to want to teach us or not? And, of course, for many of them, understandably, no, they aren't going to want to teach the people that have been living on their land. But the biggest problem with our culture, of course, is it's not land-based. We physically live on this land, but the more civilized you are, the more emotionally and relationally separated from the rest of life on Earth you become, other than humans, pardon me. Me, it's only because of our isolation from the rest of the natural world that we're able to destroy it. So, for example, a culture that's in tune with its land base, with whatever makes that land special and unique to them, who possibly has their religion tied into that specific place of land, would not and would never be able to destroy that land or allow someone else to destroy it. It's very different compared to today. It's interesting. Here there's some corporations, of course, are trying to destroy land and get minerals in Whatcom County, which is where Bellingham's located. And, of course, no one, at least us settlers who are living here, are going to stand up and defend that land with our life. And, of course, one reason is we can go somewhere else, and that's one of the problems with this culture not being land-based. You are not invested in any one piece of land, and for that reason, those in power can come in and destroy it.
Yeah, you can't see me just nodding along with every thing you're saying there, but that's great. That's really well said. The other one that sort of stands out to me, in order to defend what remains of our land base and our communities, which is kind of what you were talking about, coordinated resistance is necessary. And what does that look like?
Well, that's a great question. And it's difficult because there's so many different manifestations that resistance could take. Part of the difficulty lies in the fact that we, as in members of Fertile Ground, council members, were from white middle class North America, and so we're members of the oppressor class. And to envision a resistance from this viewpoint is, it feels sometimes like somewhat inappropriate and contrived. However, what I think it looks like generally is that people are standing up against injustices, against life and the earth, and not letting them stand. It looks like people talking, convening, meeting, showing up, speaking in public, writing letters, marching in the streets, supporting each other, growing food. And I think something that's really important is refusing to stay silent. Because once you possess knowledge, yet you remain silent, I think that's much more egregious than simply being ignorant. I think speaking out and taking action is absolutely, in whatever form, is imperative.
No, that's a good. That's a very good, very good point. Especially, I like that about if you have the knowledge, that it's important to speak up, because there's far too much silence out there, I think. What other points in We Believe do you think we should talk about?
I'll just say one, and I'm not even sure if this is on the list, but this is just a personal I Believe.
Sure.
Which is, the longer we wait to abandon the bright green approach of the mainstream environmental movement, mm-hmm. the more we'll regret it later on. So I imagine it's fairly obvious why I believe this based on my previous answers, but the longer we wait, we're just going to be kicking ourselves later, and especially future generations are going to be kicking us.
And do you have anything to add, Jeanette?
I would just like to say that I'm sure many of your listeners have heard before is this quote by Lear Keith that I keep coming back to as a guiding force, and it's so powerful, and that is, the quote is, "The task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppression with as much personal integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to confront and dismantle systems of oppression." It just so succinctly sums up everything against lifestyleism as the sole activity. It's great. I love it.
Yes, that's a great quote. You have a dismantling corporate rule 2-day workshop. And I gather that the Against Civ is a regular meeting that you guys have.
Yes, yes.
Then you have Michael Pullum, which I see is sold out and coming to talk. And then you have another workshop confronting the pornographic culture. And you have Lear Keith coming in, and some other speakers coming to that. So I'm wondering if you can talk about those events.
Well, the first one you mentioned, Dismantling Corporate Rule, it's a 2-day workshop taking place at the Skagit Valley Co-op in Mount Vernon, which is, say, about 30 miles south of Bellingham. And we're not actually sponsoring it, but we did put it on our events calendar as a way to network with other people.
Right.
It's basically about learning about corporate rule, challenging corporate personhood, and what we can do as citizens to confront that.
And we are all going to that one as well, so we're going to be there participating for sure.
I think that's an important part, though, you bring up, is that networking with other groups, though. That's really key. Cameron, have you been involved with the Confronting Pornographic Culture?
Yeah, I can. Do you want me to... I could cover Against Civ as well really quickly.
Sure, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Those two are sort of my little pet projects.
Okay.
So Against Civ, Civ being short for civilization, mm-hmm. is a weekly discussion group that my roommates and I host at our place. The group is for people under the age of 30 to come and openly talk about the world we live in. Most people my age know that as things stand now, we're pretty screwed. And, you know, let's jump to the point. In one of the classes I took last year, the question was posed, what do you think it will take to stop environmental destruction? 18 of the 20 answers involved apocalyptic scenarios resulting in the destruction of most of the human species. So to put it bluntly, a lot of my people my age, we're pretty scared. And in some ways, a lot of us are really hopeless. So this is what Against Civ is about, talking about what it's like coming of age in this crazy world. This is drawing, of course, on the tradition of the feminist movement, consciousness-raising groups, and it is very much a consciousness-raising group where we get together. We'll talk about maybe a news article that came out lately. And it's just really exciting because that's why we've limited it to the age of 30, because for whatever reason, sometimes when people get past the age of 30, you know, that's an arbitrary number, but when they get older, they tend to abstract things more. And it's really nice just being in a room full of people our age and who understand what's going on right now, because it is a really traumatic time to be growing up. But that is very much just a weekly discussion group. it's off campus, but it is advertised throughout our college. So the other event, which I am very excited about, it's the coming weekend, January 15th, 16th, and 17th, is called Confronting a Pornographic Culture. It's a three-day workshop focusing on pornography and its harmful effects on the culture. So most people listening are probably thinking, okay, pornography and environmentalism, I don't get it. Mm-hmm. Well, they might not be very, very connected on the surface, but there's a few reasons I feel this is important. First, I have a strong connection as an environmentalist to ending oppression in all realms, and this includes very much ending oppression against women and other minority groups. Pornography is one of the largest primary emergencies in the feminist movement, and it's unfortunately not being recognized as such. For your listeners out there, let me just give a brief definition of pornography, because for whatever reason in this culture, it's common for people to think that pornography is any form of media depicting something sexual, but that's not pornography. That's actually called erotica. What pornography is any form of media which sexualizes the oppression of women and other minority groups. So if I, if someone wants to videotape themselves having sex with their partner, that would be erotica. But if they wanted to tape, videos of them, beating their partner in a way that they're sexualizing that violence and then distributing that, that, of course, would be pornography. And that's what we have a problem with. That's what I very much have a problem with, identifying as a feminist as well. So, of course, what's dangerous about pornography is that it's always pushing these boundaries. How far are we going to take it? And in this age, it's starting to become even more violent than it already was, and just to this point where it's just outrageous, and the culture generally defends it. But so that's what this event is about, and we're bringing Lier Keith, Professor Gail Dines, who teaches at Wheelock in Boston, and then Rebecca Wissen, who's actually a philosophy professor as well. And so there's these three great women, and they're part of this. This is the group, Stop Porn Culture, and they're coming, and they're giving the first workshop on the West Coast. Sorry, and I've actually heard that there's a group of people coming down from BC just for this event, so that's really exciting.
Oh, yeah, that's great, yeah. No, I saw that. I said, oh, geez, I wish I was going. Anyway. Yeah, looks like a good thing. What is Deep Green Education?
Yeah, okay, well, Deep Green Education is very much just educating people on what Deep Green is. So, and Deep Green, it can very much be summarized by the radical position. So, of course, most people in this culture, when they hear radical, they think, oh, my God, extreme, anarchist. That's not really what it actually means, radical. The Latin root of it actually just means root. So radical is about getting to the core of something. And the radical political position, in general, takes the social unit to be the group or class instead of the individual. And, of course, the individual is what the bright green does, is focusing on individual approaches to the environmental crisis. Well, that's of course not what we're interested in. Strength comes in numbers. We all say this, but sometimes I think we forget it. And so that's what this Deep Green Education is about. So it's about introducing radical political ideas, radical political ideology into the discussion, but also going in and clearing up some of these other myths, like you mentioned about people thinking that what we need is better technology, meaning a more industrialized technology, solar panels or wind turbines, which the closer you look into it, the more you realize they are also earth-destroying technologies.
That they're also using this now, this, quote, green technology, to continue to take land from indigenous peoples as well, because they're doing that in South Dakota with the Dakota there on the Crow Creek Reserve. So continues that perpetuation.
That's terrible.
What are warrior classes?
Well, the warrior class, it's a leadership training correspondence course that we're developing. And its intent is to create a new class of charismatic, inspiring leaders that will spawn a greater movement throughout the world. And the aspects of this there are a lot and include public speaking skills, writing skills, and education on a broad range of deep green topics. And personal development just as a leader and in your confidence in the topics, yeah. So they basically be able to go out and give an amazing speech and inspire people and instigate leadership into forming resistance groups around wherever they go. It's basically like creating, I don't want to be too cliche, but creating more Derek Jensens, like because he's, you know, he's inspiring. You hear him speaking, you get excited, and you get angry. We want to have people have the skills to do that in their own communities.
Well, that's not a bad thing, more Derek Jensen's. Positive visioning. What is that? That was one of the other things you were talking about on your website there.
Positive visioning is a common practice in the environmental movement and on the liberal left. It means when someone restricts their range of thought or approaches to only what they consider to be positive. Mm-hmm. So most of us have run into examples of this. If I'm in a class and I say, the earth is being killed, we need to do something, it's really common for me to hear someone respond, oh, that is just so negative of you to say, and I don't want to put that kind of negative energy out into the world because it will only come back to me and it can only do more harm. Right. So this starts to sound really new agey, and that's because it is. But I very much consider myself a new ageist. I'm interested in those things, but you know, it's how far do you let that penetrate your ideology. I wouldn't have a problem with positive visioning, but it ends up being the only approach that a lot of people take in regards to environmental destruction. They'll say, okay, environmental destruction is bad, so I'm not going to talk about it. Resistance is violent and angry, even though, of course, it's not, but that's what they think. Right. Resistance must be violent, it must be angry, and violence and anger are bad, so I'm not even going to consider it. Again, most of us, we probably know someone who does this, and it's really annoying as well as counterproductive. The most important thing we can do right now is to be honest with ourselves. We need to be honest. We are losing this struggle. The environmental movement is not working right now, and we need to rethink what we're doing. I'm not interested in sounding positive or negative or whatever. I'm interested in doing what's effective and leaving a healthy land base for the generations that come after me.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. We really do need to be honest with ourselves of where we're at right now, and I hear that. I remember I was talking. We were at a food group, but we were talking about different books, and I was talking about a document called "Climate Code Red" and just about where we were climate wise. And I had the exact same response. You know, it's like, you know, you're so being so negative, and that's such a negative way of putting things. And it's like, you know what? I'm not putting on the rosy glasses here. This is where we got to really look at where we're at. And then,
right. So anyway. That'd be realistic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I was thinking, it's so funny that you bring these things up, and then it almost seems as if the people get mad at you, which is so counterproductive, because, of course, yeah. If they're mad about the climate change, they need to be mad about the industries, at the CEOs, at the people that are responsible.
Right, exactly. Because I know that in your presentation, you felt like you ended up having to rewrite or talk. Be very careful how you presented yourself.
Yes, very much. So addressing some community concerns was a document that we released that we realized we had to release after we finally came out. And this document covers a lot of issues, such as positive visioning, mm-hmm. such as the role of resistance and the possibility of violence within that resistance. So when we first came out to the public, there was a response from not people on the right, but people on the left, a few other activist groups that were similar to us being environmental groups. And they implied that they wanted to distance themselves from anything that we were involved in. Their reasoning was that violence was implicit in what we suggested, and violence is bad, so therefore we are bad, Fertile Ground is bad. And we chose to release this document to clarify our beliefs without backing down, and this is on our website. Mm-hmm. We ultimately said that we're not interested in violence. We're interested in protecting the land, and we will support whatever it takes, violent or not, to protect that land. That is our primary interest. So right. As you can see, and I'm sure any listeners who are activists as well probably know, violence seems to be a large issue in activism.
Yeah.
And it's ironic, of course, because while these people are concerned about the possible defensive use of violence that you might be suggesting, there's entire corporations, entire nations out there right now committing massive amounts of actual violence against the environment and minority peoples, mm-hmm. Without any realistic opposition. So it's that, of course, we need to be opposed.
Yeah, exactly. It seems people's definitions of violence suddenly change when it, you know, comes to having their computer or something.
Yeah. Very convenient.
I think it's also, oh, I'm sorry.
No, I thought that was it.
Oh, I was just going to say that I think it's also important to differentiate between violence and destruction of property.
Yes.
Because so often people think like, oh, I'm smashing Starbucks. That's violence. No, it's not. It's smashing a window. It's not hurting a being.
Right.
I think if people understood that a little bit better, there wouldn't be as much of a problem.
Well, that's another whole issue. I don't have time to get into that. That Derek actually raises in the culture of make-believe. And that is the morality of property. And somehow, because I remember I was at a climate change training camp, and one of the things in it was you stood on, they made a quadrant, and then they would ask questions as to what you would do. And the quadrants were, this is violent, but you would support it. This is nonviolent, you would support it. Or it was nonviolent, you wouldn't support it. Or it was violent and you wouldn't support it. So it's based upon how much support you would give something and how much whether you viewed it as nonviolent or violent. And It was, so they would ask a question, and you could sort of, you know, hedge and even stand right in the middle if you felt like it, like you were really weren't sure. But what I found really interesting is there was one question about holding a candlelight vigil on a corporate leader's lawn. So you're going to have this on his lawn, you're going to have this candlelight vigil. And the real separation was most people saw it as nonviolent, although a couple of people did see it as violent, not very many. But most people saw Yeah, well, that was the thing, yeah. But most people saw it as nonviolent. But the real separation was whether it was supported or not, because it came down really along property lines. The whole issue of being on somebody's, quote, property. I mean, and my position was, well, it's not their property. If they're in North America,
exactly.
they're on stolen land anyway. So, what was also very interesting is some of the most pacifist people, though, or that were there, were actually didn't see it as violent. So I thought that was good. But I also, though, I really thought that it was very interesting how a lot of the separation came right down to the whole issue around property. So I think that's a huge discussion I think needs to be had somewhere. Okay, so now I get to ask you the other questions. Okay, so these are the random questions that I've got in front of me 12 questions from Derek's Endgame questions that he wrote. I'm not sure when exactly he wrote this. I think because it looks like some of them also came out of some thoughts that he had around what we believe behind too. So there are a whole bunch of thoughts and questions that he's obviously had for a while. And so I took 12 of them. Each of you choose two numbers between 1 and 12, and then I'll ask you the questions.
Okay, do you want both of us each to choose two numbers?
Yeah, and preferably different.
Okay. Cameron, go ahead.
Okay, I will do, I'll just be brave and do 1 and 2.
1 and 2, okay. And
I'll take... 11 and 12.
11 and 12. Okay, great. Okay, that works well. All right, Cameron, here are your two. Do you ever deny your own experience in favor of what you have been taught? Why or why not? If so, how? You want me to read that again?
Yes, please.
Do you ever deny your own experience in favor of what you have been taught? Why or why not? And if so, how?
Actually, you know, I first thought I wasn't going to have an example, but I do. I've never had a dog. I've never really had a pet in my life, but living in the apartment, I'm in an apartment now off campus, and we have a dog. So it's fascinating to me looking at the experience with her. She's a half German Shepherd, half Rottweiler, and sometimes she'll be talking to me and, you know, clearly expressing that she wants to go outside or, you know, that she's hungry or something.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this voice in my head that'll say, like, oh, you know, at first there was this voice in my head that would say, you know, oh, it's almost like she's trying to tell you something. It's almost like she's trying to tell me something. And then I said, no, it's not almost like it. It is. She is telling me something.
Right.
So, yeah, that is one experience where there is this mainstream cultural voice there was in my head. And
right.
The most
yeah.
important thing, I think, in that situation for me was just to, you know, recognize it over and over.
Okay, so here's your second question then. Who decides for you whether the air you breathe and the water you drink is contaminated with contagions?
Oh, who decides? That's actually a great question, if that's what, you know, someone was basing their activism off of.
Right, yeah.
Due to size. Well, I'm very much central to the land, so I would say first and foremost, the land would decide, but since I'm not, of course, very connected with my land base here, I'm not sure how I would know. So the most practical answer right now probably just would be the statistic that all streams, this is a USGS, so United States Geographical Survey, statistics saying that every stream in the United States is contaminated with carcinogens. So, in fact, in this case, if there is a conservative group, you know, a conservative organization that is telling you your water's dirty, you know, you might as well listen to it.
Okay, Jeanette, here's your two questions. Are you aware of the power you hold as a result of your race, class, gender? Describe a time when you have used it to your advantage.
Oh, wow, that's a great question. You know, I try to be aware of that. As, you know, being white, I have a lot of power that I didn't necessarily ask for, but it came with the culture, I suppose. However, the community I live in Bellingham, it is predominantly white, and I don't often feel like I experience that disparity of some sort of, you know, power over another group. So I'm trying to think of an example specifically where that's happened. You know, I can't, maybe I should get another question because I can't think of a good example. No, I know, I'm sure it happens unconsciously all the time, which is, I'm embarrassed to say that I can't think of an example.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I know it certainly does happen. You know, it's inevitable.
Yeah. And at the same work, at the Zoom training camp, we did an exercise around that where we all lined up in a straight line. And then you were asked a series of questions, and you would step forward or backwards depending on whether that you could answer yes or no. And it was very interesting to see how the land, the lines dispersed. And of course, it was set up so that deliberately, if you were a white male with educated parents that went to college and things like that and had high-paying jobs, you were way ahead of the line. And it was interesting. The people the farthest back were, there was a pair of women and one man of color that was quite far back. But for the most part, a lot of us would step forward, were stepping forward, because almost everybody at the organization were people of privilege from one level of, you know, one reason or another, either the class or color or gender. So that was an interesting little test. Okay, I'll ask you a different question, but I'll ask you number 12, which is one of the ones you ask. Okay. Is it possible for humans to live sustainably? How would it be different from how we are living now?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. I mean, obviously humans have lived sustainably for thousands and tens of thousands of years before civilization took hold. And how would it differ? I think the main difference is that, as Cameron has mentioned before, is that people are connected to the earth. They're connected to the rhythms. They're connected to every being that lives in their immediate region. They understand its processes. They understand its cycles. And they're part of that process. They're not seeking to dominate and to shape it. They take their place amidst that, and they work with it, and they accept that just because humans have this capability to, you know, to dominate and to create systems of domination doesn't mean that we should. Because we are ultimately, we're wild animals, and to take that place as that,
right,
I think is the key.
Found another question, which is kind of fits with what you were just talking about as well. And that would say, when was the most recent time you felt awe? What was the cause?
Last time I felt off?
Awe, as in wowed by something.
Oh, awe, as in awe. Oh, God. That's a big difference. Wow. Well, we live in Bellingham, but we live in a really beautiful part of the earth. It's so beautiful here. We have mountains. We have the bay. It's amazing. I spent time away, and every time I'm away, I just miss it so bad. And so, you know, I live in Bellingham. I live amidst this, but where I live is in, like, downtown. So out my window, it's concrete, all directions concrete buildings. However, I can easily, it's only like a two-block walk where I can go, and I can see the bay, and I can see the San Juan Islands. And anytime I go there, or if I go to even more so like a moving body of water, for me to be able to be next to a stream or a river and watch it and listen to it is incredibly soothing, and it's so calming just to watch it and to listen to it and to feel connected to it. So that doesn't happen nearly often enough, but I think bodies of water, being near those and just being with them is really, that does it for me.
Right. Well, I really appreciate you guys taking the time. So thank you very much.
Great.
Take care, guys.
Talk to you later. Yeah. Bye.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, that's the show, folks. Thank you very much for listening. And remember, the resistance needs you. Taking us out is the Filthy Politicians with So Hard.
Stop now for a minute. Take a look. It's all beginning. We've been working so hard. Stop now for a minute. Take a look. It's all beginning. We've been working so hard. Stop now for a minute, take a look, it's all beginning, we've been working so hard. Stop now for a minute, take a look, it's all beginning, we've been working so hard.
Dreams shatter as you wake to the buzz of the alarm. Once again, taking dreams from us. Hop in the car that you need to get to the slave ship to work all day so you can make the payment. Work in stores that we can't afford to shop in. Working chores, but we can't afford to stop then. Time is money, money, watching the clock spin. Boss got a Mercedes while you pushing a Datsun. Get a student loan just to get a job, just to punch in, punch out to pay that loan off. Working your days away, just a slave in a trade. Kinda funny though, we don't see it that way. Chop down trees to build factories. Pump toxins into the air we breathe. Then flood the seas with disease. See, we are working hard for a future that we might not see.
Stop now for a minute. Take a look, it's all beginning. We've been working so hard. Stop now for a minute. Take a look, it's all beginning. We've been working so hard.
So you wake up one day and it all seems so wrong. How has it all gone on for so long? Come from a good family though, but we don't know what we do to farmers in Mexico. Feels like your heart is breaking each time that you awaken to another level of a tragedy. The truth of what's being taken. There's a lot behind the curtain. That's one thing I know for certain, that it's hard work to find out what's hurting. Watching TV when you're not busy working. Hard work to find the right thing to do, but it helps when you realize it lied to you. There's folks out there that feel like this too. The earth desperately needs you to
stop now for a minute. Take a look, it's all beginning. We've been working so hard. Stop now for a minute. Take a look, it's all beginning. We've been working so hard.
So then you try working the court system long enough just to find out that it's all just sparked. That cancer took your sister, and then the judge dismissed her case, 'cause you can find his face in the wall of the corporate banquet hall that makes all the poison that takes girlfriends and boyfriends away. They need an army for a reason. Keep destroying while they're breathing, but you're breathing too, giving back to the trees what they give to you. You've got the tools that you need to use to deconstruct this fucked up view. When you see the system in a whole new light, better start working hard to protect life.
Stop now for a minute, take a look, it's all beginning, we've been working so hard. Stop now for a minute, take a look, it's all beginning, we've been working so hard.
Yours pension. Message one. God damn it, an entire generation pumping gas, waiting tables, slaves with white collars. All raised on television to believe that one day we'd all be millionaires and movie gods and rock stars. But we won't. The middle children of history, man. No purpose, place. Our great war is a spiritual war. Our Great Depression is our lives.
Stop now for a minute, take a look, it's all beginning. We've been working so hard. Stop now for a minute, take a look, it's all beginning. We've been working so hard. Stop now for a minute, take a look, it's all beginning. We've been working so hard. Stop now for a minute, take a look, it's all beginning. We've been working so hard.